This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 1st of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 295 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's show, thought you knew the English language? Well, think again. We celebrate words such as jackstraw and cowbelly as we meet the man whose new book celebrates the lush lexicon of Britain's landscape.
Also ahead, how we live in the future. We hear about an exhibition looking at the London that never quite was, exploring the failures of modernism and regeneration.
And writer Mark Gavissa reflects on coming of age in South Africa's City of Gold. He joins us to discuss his memoir of a self and a city lost and found in Johannesburg.
All that, plus our look ahead to the stories to set the news agenda in the week ahead with our very own Tom Edwards. That's the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24. Just clearing my throat there before the show.
Well, I cannot wait to meet Dominic Tyler, who's coming in to talk about his book about the British landscape. Because so far, I haven't been able to say lush lexicon very well. Lush lexicon is quite a complicated thing to say.
Lush lexicon of the English landscape.
We shouldn't have had so much of such a lush lunch. Then we'd have been okay.
I know. Well, you always will start off with a sherry's, Andrew, on a Sunday, won't you? You're incorrigible. Especially when you're celebrating the close of an issue, I sometimes think you never know when to stop.
I love a sherry. Oh, that's nice.
Do you like a fino or a cream? Amontillado?
I love them all, please. The cheese as well.
That's what I like. I think that's the kind of stuff that we wouldn't mind a few bubbles in it. Because we should tell people that we've had a hard week with our nose against the what is it?
Typewriter. No, it's not a typewriter. We've finished another issue, another wonderful issue, which is our style issue.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why I'm so nattily dressed today.
Then we are finishing the third of our giant books, which will go to it's kind of finished on Monday, but I'm afraid it won't be out till August. But that's a bit of a process.
Are you praying that someone who wants to buy the book isn't listening?
Well, no, but they can warm up. And then, more importantly, on Monday, a new world of Monocle 24. It's going to be all four new shows.
Are you doing all of them? Are you presenting all
of
them?
No. Four new shows, new formats, new jingles even. They'll get you going.
I thought it was just the way you were sitting.
I wondered why my trousers were so tight. It's the new jingles. No, it's there's a whole new world of radio that's coming our way. And that we know a gentleman, actually, don't we?
We know someone that maybe can fill us in better about this. Let's bring him out of his news closet. It's Ted Woods.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest-hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much. We must get a new one for you next week.
Talking of new jingles, yeah.
I'm beginning to suspect that you don't really mean that.
Well, it's because people love it so much. It's very popular
around here. That's true.
Now, so the big news is Monocle 24 next week.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the League Cup final later that I'm heading off to.
No, I thought you'd be in the pub already.
I'm keeping my powder dry.
Let's talk about the big news. Yeah. Monocle 24. So what are the highlights for you next week?
New schedule. Well, I think you mentioned new programmes. Yes. Just get your ears around this, people. We have things like a big interview. Keep it under wraps, though, the special guest, the launch guests for that. But that's a sort of long-form chat. With one of our senior editors in conversation with truly inspiring people. Yet more inspiration from Monocle 24. You probably thought it wasn't possible.
Then Rob's doing something special, live sessions.
Rob's live sessions. Well, I mean, it's music. It's not just Rob. It's just riffing. We have lots of incredible acts who join us constantly.
We're going to have some good people.
And they're going to. It's a sort of a proper dedicated platform for.
And it's a 15-minute show that's going to kind of premiere every Saturday to download for your weekend.
Exactly.
New music. Exclusive from us.
Exactly. Wonderful stuff. And Rob will probably be having some chats with some of the kind of movers and shakers in that music scene as well. We've got a kind of a news roundup, Andrew. So I know a lot of people who listen regularly to Monocle 24 are frequently travelling. They might miss, a lot of the big news stories of the week. They can find out that with the conveniently named recap, which will bring them up to speed with all the stories they may have missed. And on it goes. Our arts review every day. Great critics from around the world joining us to set the agenda, whether it's literature, books, art, film. They'll be chatting to Rob, they'll be chatting to other editors and telling us what you need to see that week for your cultural well-being as well as your news sustenance.
Well, this was kind of all starting in the morning. But the other big thing I just want to say before we come back to the other news that's happening around the world is we're also launching the Monocle Restaurant Awards. And that's going to kick off on the menu this week. So tune in. We're going to be naming the best restaurants in the world. We're talking about real restaurants that are kind of in the Monocle world, and we're going to kind of shake up all those restaurant lists. We've got a big plan, and it's going to be announced on the menu with Marcus Hippie on Friday.
I'm starving.
Yorkshire pudding, yeah. Yorkshire pudding restaurant.
So it's an exciting time.
Very exciting time.
Okay,
now let's go back to the League Cup final.
No, let's not talk about that. We'll just be tempting fate.
Okay.
You really are.
May the best team win, is all I'll say about that. Well, let's rattle through a couple of things. This is a fun way to start. Wednesday, it's World Maths Day. So I've got some maths questions.
Oh, no, don't do that.
I'm not going to do that. But World Maths Day. So make sure to be on your arithmetical best for midweek.
Okay.
Thursday, now we talked about the big Westminster Dog Show in the US. It's only fair to give a quick doff of the hat or collar or whatever it would be to Crufts, our own
cock of the leg, I think it is.
Cock of the leg.
Crufts. I'm glad it's like an onomatopoeic word, isn't it?
Yeah, Crufts. So that's on Thursday that gets started.
Are you going out for a walk? That's how you talk to dogs.
You've got all the usual favourites. But there's other things. They have the canine heroes. So they have all the kind of very posh, fancy dogs, you know, with the haircuts and all that.
This is when we need Tom Reynolds to do his impersonation of your dog that you don't have.
Daddy!
which hates me because I'm an absent father.
Because you're at work all the time. Yeah. So Tom Reynolds has been talked about on the show many times before. He's now created a personality for a dog that doesn't exist, because Tom wanted to have a dog and hasn't got one yet, but he's imagined that this poor dog would always be on its own because you're here all the time.
It's terrible, isn't it? And I think Tom Reynolds needs help.
And he does, but he does his whole voice, and it always starts off, "Daddy."
It's really disturbing.
It's quite weird, isn't it?
That's a window into the disturbing world of Tom Reynolds.
It's strange.
And our busy lives here at Monocle 24.
Exactly. When we're not, it's almost as if
he's going to expect you're going to be having like a dog in a bonnet in a pram.
But that's what you're supposed to do.
Dado!
Please stop doing that.
Okay.
The Armory, Rob, is this week from Wednesday.
Yes, the Armory Show.
In New York, which is one of the big ones worth mentioning. What else have we got?
It's going to be interesting this year. It's all got, there's the sort of Middle East focus, lots of, I think, curators and galleries, and they're trying to sort of bridge a lot of gaps and bridge sort of two worlds, I think. And certainly two art kind of societies as well. So I think that's going to be quite a good lineup for the Armory Show.
And then I've got a couple of novelty items for you, which I know you love.
Yes.
It's Pie Week in Britain.
Yeah. I like a pie.
No, Andrew looks absolutely...
I don't like a pie.
Yeah.
What, all pies you're dismissing?
Because Andrew doesn't eat meat, and what I would say is it's not really the best pies you have to really have, you know. Why would you
want a vegetable pie? Not interested.
No, I forgot about the vegetarianism. I feel I should apologise.
I'm trying to think of the pie I like. No. Pie charts, maybe?
Paella.
Back to maths week.
Okay, well then, what about National Bed Month? Everyone likes that.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a
month-long celebration of beds
for a whole month.
For a whole month.
Who? Yeah. I would love to see the lobbying group behind some of these.
It's the Sleep Council, Rob.
Oh right,
they've got a vested interest.
Okay,
so get amongst it. You might not hear from me for the next few weeks.
The phone just rings and rings when you phone the Sleep Council, and they never answer. Okay, we like that.
That's what's going on. But the main thing, yeah, exactly. Tune in from tomorrow. Lots of exciting new programmes and developments on M24. Even more exciting, I should say, than usual.
And you'll be here even longer.
Exactly.
That poor dog is just going to be waiting non-stop.
The dog's going to be just listening to the radio.
the dog that doesn't exist. Crufts. Yeah.
Good. Thank you very much.
Who's a good boy then?
Pleasure as always.
From the fens of eastern England to the western isles of Scotland, Britain's landscape is rich not only in its texture and geology, but in its language too. Dig down a little further beyond the country's meadows, Munros and salt marshes, and you'll find a wonderful lexicon waiting to be discovered. But only a minority of us can truly speak that language.
Well, luckily for us, we know a man who can. He's Dominic Tyler. And in his new book, Uncommon Ground, A Word Lover's Guide to the British Landscape, he introduces us to words such as jackstraw, zorn, cowbelly, and much more besides. And Dominic joins us in the studio now. Dominic, thank you for coming to see us. A huge number. We should explain how the book works. So there's a kind of a photograph on one side and an explanation of the word that's connected to it. So, you know, here I have a peat hag, and here I have a sastrugi, and we won't test you on all these now. But first of all, just getting all of these images.
Sounds like you need to blow your nose, Andrew.
How long did it take you to find all these things and go around and actually document them? Because there are some extraordinary sights in here.
I started collecting words a while ago, but the project, the Uncommon Ground project, kind of was about a year from beginning to end, and that was in, you know, travelling up and down, finding places, finding words, taking pictures. So yeah, about a year for the content of the book.
But also for the book to work, many of these words are connected to things which are also dependent on weather, and so you couldn't just go off and shoot it in 2 months anyway, because I presume you needed to be in some places in summer and some places in winter.
Yeah, absolutely. So I started off in January, February, and sort of programmed in trips to Scotland so I could get lots of the kind of snowy, icy, mountainous stuff then. And then obviously planned to do some of the kind of springtime stuff after that. There was a kind of seasonality to it, definitely. But also the weather-dependent stuff, a lot of the features in the book are quite ephemeral. So they weren't things that I knew that I could get. And some of them even just things that kind of cropped up in the course of the journey and just sort of got them as and when.
I don't want to be accused of asking a lazy question here, but, well, you often have people that say, where did the idea come from? But did you just enjoy landscapes, you enjoy walking, you enjoy driving, whatever, through these landscapes and wondering what the names of things are and finding they didn't have them or they had them and they were of strange etymological interest? How did it start?
The idea sort of came from lots of different directions at once. I grew up in the countryside, but I now live in London, so I kind of feel that kind of panging disconnection
from
the landscape. So I have that kind of fascination. But then I did a project on swimming outdoors back in 2006, 2007, a book called Wild Swim. And it was in the course of that I found myself trying to describe particular journeys over moorland or, you know, through woodland and not having the language to describe it. And that was both slightly shameful, but also very frustrating. So I looked for a resource that would kind of fill in the gaps, and there wasn't anything. So it's one of those classic, you know, you'd write the book that you want to
read. You want to read.
And that's what Uncommon Ground was for me, kind of fills in those gaps.
Many of these words are kind of extraordinary. So there's things like a Ginny Greengrass, and I'm going to get this one wrong, an epilimnion.
Epilimnium, that's a lovely word, isn't it?
Isn't it nice?
Well, if you can say it,
sounds like something a footballer might sprain.
Obviously, I wasn't very good at my geography. But actually, let's move on to that Ginny Green Teeth. So this is like a little pool. It's covered with
It's covered with duckweed, isn't it? Well, the thing about Ginny Green Teeth, which is interesting, is that Ginny Green Teeth she's a folkloric character. She's a mythical character. And she provides a really useful function. She scares kids, basically, away from wet places, you know, ponds where they could fall in and drown. So she's a bit like a hag, you know, she's got long green hair, described teeth, and she sort of draws people into the water and then drowns them. It's a cautionary tale. But the interesting thing about Ginny Greenteeth, a Ginny Greenteeth as a noun, is that that mythical creature has become a word for places like that. So where you have ponds which are kind of completely covered with duckweed, so you can't see the water, or where you have streams that are so kind of bedraggled with moss and fern and lichens that they're kind of completely green, they have become Ginny Greenteeths.
And tell me, so many of these pictures, I think all these pictures are extraordinary examples of the thing that you're trying to describe. How did you find, you want a Ginny Greenteeth. Did you kind of, is there a website for them? How did you go around locating the perfect one?
Well, I heard the word. I heard it from a guy up in Cumbria, and he had a particular location in mind. And I went to look at it, but it didn't look great. I photographed it, it didn't look great. And then I sort of kept it in mind. And the Ginny Greenteeth I actually photographed in the book, which is a lovely example of one that's completely carpeted with duckweed. I actually found in Norfolk. So I kind of had an image, but it wasn't the perfect image, and I just kept my eyes open. Once you kind of know these things, and once you kind of want to see them, then
you've got a little corner of your brain that is forever searching for the perfect green
Exactly, yeah, and I'll probably find the perfect one.
Damn, I've seen it, and the book's just come out. One of my favourite things about your book is, obviously, is the names of the things, which seem to me like they might be good names for prog rock bands regional music festivals in England. One's called Wool Gathering, Sparrow Blast, Thunder Eggs.
Well, that's prog rock, isn't it?
That is totally, yeah. Halt. And you can imagine John Peel kind of intoning, and we've got the new record here from Sarn. And a Sarn, it's the Welsh word for a causeway. And its plural, Sarnau, is the name given to the group of shingle reefs that extend in parallel out into Cardigan Bay. Yeah. This is so amazing. This is a wonderful thing. This you should make a TV programme of this. This is absolutely, this has got...
Open to all.
I've got swooping, kind of like maybe some Elgar and some swooping helicopter shots.
Yeah, helicopters.
Zooming
definitely.
Over, and you walking. What's your TV persona like? Do you think you'd be sort of in people's faces, or do you think you'd be the subtle interlocutor?
No, I think I'd be the sort of Annabelle Rice with the whole a boiler suit.
Annika Rice.
Yeah, Annika Rice. As soon as you mentioned helicopters, that came to mind for some reason.
Yeah.
Now,
of Annabelle Croft.
Annabelle Croft.
Who actually also presented that TV programme. She was the one after Annika Rice.
Anyway, we're digressing here, I think.
Sorry.
I want to come back to the book.
Well, for our international listeners, Google it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I also like the fact that many of the terms, obviously, you may have learned in your geography class. Yeah. But there's one here which is a very contemporary one, and perhaps you could just talk us through the witch's knickers.
Witch's knickers, well, this is probably the most modern term in the book, and it actually comes from the turn of the millennium from Ireland. And it is a plastic bag which has been caught, snagged in a tree or in a kind of barbed wire fence or whatever. We will have seen hundreds of these. Everyone will have seen hundreds of these. They kind of flap around in the wind and they look a bit forlorn. It's very subtle. So the idea, I think, is that a low-flying witch has caught her underwear on the tree or the branch, or maybe, a witch perched in the tree has taken off too quickly and left knickers behind.
And when you were choosing the terms, obviously, so we have witch's knickers, which is a very modern and a very, a wonderfully descriptive term. You have some very simple terms like lowlands, which you decide to take a picture of. How did you decide which words would make it onto the list, and how many should be kind of technical, how many should be Celtic, how many should have some kind of history behind them?
I didn't have like a strict quotient of each of those, but I kind of felt when a section got too much of one thing, I kind of looked for another thing. And also the things to be successful entries, they had to be images that were kind of interesting and stories that were kind of interesting, and a mix between the two. I mean, sometimes the images are less interesting than the stories, sometimes the stories are more interesting than the images, but there has to be some kind of balance between those. So, I mean, that was quite an easy process in the end.
And did it make you look at the British countryside? You've found all these extraordinary things where I think most people in their life might see a few of these things. There's an extraordinary example of an erratic, which is a giant rock that's been left perched on a tiny rock. Mm. Now, I imagine some people would go and see that because it's an extraordinary thing. But most of the other things, maybe you'd see them at the corner of your eye, you wouldn't register them. Has it made you think afresh about the British Isles?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really wanted to feature those overlooked things, which sometimes have lovely stories. They have lovely cultural stories, or they have lovely linguistic stories. And one of the aims of the book was to, not in a kind of big campaigning way, but in a sort of gentle way, just sort of say, look at the details. Some of the details are actually really quite special.
I don't think there's any more romantic idea and word, and perhaps photograph, than the Moonglade.
That's
which
lovely,
is what
isn't
that
it?
Is. Isn't that wonderful? Which seems very, it feels like it's been stolen from a sonnet, doesn't it? It's really, really a wonderful one, which is, by the way, the path that the reflection of the moon makes in water, which is a fantastic poetic.
And isn't it nice to have a word for that?
It's great to have a word. Yeah. There should be a word for everything. And that's what I love about this book, loving both the British countryside and words. It is absolutely balm to anyone that loves both of those things. And obviously, there's new things in here as well, like tide rack, which always presumably existed, but seems particularly potent, by the way, is the word almost for the stuff that gets left behind once stuff's been washed up on a beach.
Yeah, so left behind
so
by
like
the high
driftwood,
tide,
but also the kind of, also bits of plastic and polystyrene and boxes and bits and bobs, which is a strange thing. And tide rack is a strange, because there's something about that that's associated with the worry we might have about the dirtiness of
exactly,
the sea.
Exactly, yeah, kind of rack and ruin and everything going to the dogs. But you're right that tide rack has always existed because things have always floated on the sea, but modern tide rack is a very different thing, and it kind of refers to very different anxieties.
And that sounds really Edward Lear as well, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
Slithy toads, yeah, and all that.
And perhaps the final one for me, which I think is also just a wonderful word, is desire path.
Yeah.
And this is just literally... like,
that sounds like something from a sort of Apple Mac meeting, doesn't it?
No, but
what's your desire path for this?
It's kind of a shortcut. But what I also like is you've done some investigation around these terms to try and understand their etymology, their derivation, where they came from. And you, in this one, you say it's a bit of a mystery. People thought it came from a book in the 50s. It turns out it doesn't quite.
Yeah, and no, I thought it did as well. And when I went, I thought the desire path, the phrase desire path came from a book called The Poetics of Space by Gaston Bachelard, which is a great book to say you've read but not actually read. And I thought this phrase came from him, but when I went to look it up, I kind of read the book and it's not in there, but lots of people kind of cite it as the source of this phrase, and it turns out that it's a misunderstanding. It's one of those things that got repeated ad infinitum on the internet, but no one's ever kind of really checked. Well, maybe some people have, but so I checked and it wasn't there. And so desire path is one of those things, it's a shortcut in a park. You know, you see it cut across the grass and footfall will have made this unofficial path on the grass. That's a desire path. It expresses the desires of people to go from A to B in a way that hasn't been officially sanctioned by the people who've laid out the park. And it's a really interesting term, but it's not from Gaston Bachelard. I'd love to know where it came from.
Shall I make any bad jokes? Finish on.
You finish on a bad joke.
This is the space left between the coirs scooped out by neighbouring glaciers, steep-sided ridges weathered and honed to knife-like edges. It's time to arrête.
Oh, well done. Well, Dominic, thank you very much for coming in to see us. That was Dominic Tyler, and his book is Uncommon Ground, and it's going to be out later this month.
Should we have a song related to one of the topics, Andrew?
Yes, please. What would that be?
Back to the Future with a bit of the Lemonheads.
Okay,
Shake your lemon heads.
Don't think you can do that, not on radio.
This is Outdoor Type by the Lemonheads.
Always had a roof above me, always paid the rent, and I never set foot inside a tent.
That was Outdoor Type by the Lemonheads. I don't know, you can read into that what you will, but a fine song.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story. Sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine, and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. With bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents, Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Hey, head back in time to 1970s Johannesburg, and you'd find a society ridden with division, forming deep scars rendered by the everyday violence of apartheid. But look a little longer, and you'd also find a young Mark Gevisser poring over maps of his hometown, engrossed by his parents' street guide that allowed him to plot his place in the city.
Fast forward a few decades and we have Lost and Found in Johannesburg, Mark's account of growing up as the gay son of Jewish immigrants in South Africa's City of Gold. Telling the story of a man, his city and his very self, it's an intimate tale of place, memory and identity. The memoir has just been released in paperback by Granta, and Mark joins us now on the line from Cape Town. Mark, thanks for coming on the show. I think, first of all, it'd be good for you to explain your childhood, your family's role in that place that was South Africa back then as a Jewish family. In one ways, you know, obviously part of the white community, but in one ways, another way, outsiders as well.
Yeah, you know, by the time, firstly, thanks for having me on your show. By the time I was born, my family, my parents were second generation, it was their parents who came to the country, was very well established as part of white South Africa. And there was this really important shift that happened to Jews in South Africa around the middle of the century when apartheid began. Until that point, they were sort of, Jews were sort of considered as second-class citizens and sort of not quite white. And one of the things I do in the book is I go to the cemetery, the old Johannesburg cemetery, and I look at the way the Jews are put in the cemetery as a buffer between the whites and the blacks, between the Christians and the heathens, in fact. And that is something of a role that Jews play. But then once sort of white supremacism really kicked in the mid-20th century, with apartheid in 1948, and also once the State of Israel got accepted and there were these two pariah states that developed this very strong relationship with each other, Jews were kind of, if you like, admitted into the lager being, you know, the circle of ox wagons in which whites protected themselves against the sort of savaging hordes beyond. And so by the time I was born, even though we were Jewish and as Jews we were very much part of a minority, we were first and foremost whites, and all the privileges accorded to whites were accorded to us.
And we talked about the fact that your book's just come out in paperback, Mark. On the cover is the inevitable map, which was so much part of your story, especially as a kid, I guess. Where did the fascination with maps come from? Was it so that you could see the places that you weren't allowed to go?
You know, that's the question I try and answer in the book. I mean, I think I could probably form a support group of all your listeners who had these nerdy childhoods with their noses and maps. I mean, there's something about a certain kind of kid that gets attracted to maps. And for me, what I think it was is I think it was about me sort of having this very safe, very secure. I came from an upper middle class family. My parents were together. I was raised in a lager, if you like, you know, in this very secure white lager. But there was something I sort of didn't belong. There was something in me that needed to escape. And because I was a little boy, I couldn't escape physically. So I had to escape using maps and imagining myself sort of outside of the perimeter of our household. And I think the thing that I've come to as an adult is what wasn't, the reason why I didn't fit in and I didn't belong was because I had a sort of different sexuality and even gender identity to what boys of my, you know, around me, my brothers had. I was a, if you like, proto-gay. And so in a way, it was my sexuality that I think that propelled me to maps and that got me trying to, having sort of feeling queer, feeling a little bit other and different because of my sexuality rather than because of my religion, that got me to kind of seek escape in maps. And the game that I played that sort of forms the framing metaphor for the book was a game that I've subsequently called Dispatcher, where I would where I'd find the street map to Johannesburg and I'd use a phone book. And I would find an address in the phone book and then find where that person lived in the street map and dispatch a courier with goodies to that address. And I could play this game for hours and I'd usually play it in the back of my father's car in the garage because otherwise I'd get into trouble for removing the map book from the car. And once, inevitably, I found a black name in the phone book. There weren't too many of those because most black homes didn't have telephones. And this black name was in a township called Alexandra, which I'd heard of before. And then I went to find Alexandra in the street atlas. And my first shock was that Alexandra was on the next page to where I lived. It was so close, literally the next place. And yet it might as well have been on another planet for me. And the next shock was that there was no way of plotting a route through. There was no mapped route between the black township and the white suburb. And this was the beginning of the dawning of my consciousness of apartheid. And this happened when I was sort of 7 years old. So the conceit of the book is that during my adulthood, dispatching myself to all the places that I could only sort of imagine and dream of as a child, because as this sort of, you know, corralled white, very comfortable white South African, I only went to a township for the first time when I was 18. The only black people I knew until I was 18 were people in service to me and my family.
Mark, you talk really eloquently about being gay in South Africa, and especially, again, maybe it was an honorary thing to be made almost like an honorary white part of the team, but you point out that actually in the 60s, many kind of gay people led quite open lives without any kind of trouble. Why was it so liberal in one way and so closed in another?
Yeah, I think that white South Africa always made, not always, but you know, after the war, Second World War, when a kind of a community of homosexual men kind of stayed in the city and didn't go back to their families once they were demobilized, a sort of gay subculture developed in downtown Johannesburg, which is my hometown. And that subculture was kind of permitted within a kind of an equivalent of Soho or Greenwich Village in Johannesburg, a place called Hillbrow, which has always been the sort of bohemian place, the immigrant place. And within that context, you know, gay people could live in their ghetto. But, you know, so growing up, there were quite a lot of gay people around me, but they were not open. So, you know, there was a couple who I remember very vividly, but when one of the men from the couple came to my parents for dinner, he would either come alone or bring a girlfriend with him. But nonetheless, when he came and, you know, when another gay man came to do interior decorating with my mother, he sort of came as a gay man. So there were spaces that were allowed for gay men or lesbians within society, the sports field for lesbians within white gay society, but it was very circumscribed.
I thought think there was a moment in the book where you were accosted by a young black guy with a gun. You were mugged.
That happened 3 years ago, and that basically forms the frame. That's another frame of the book, as well as the dispatcher map, which is that, I mean, basically what happened was is that I was, you know, I'd finished my manuscript and I was about to hand it into my publisher, and I had my manuscript in my bag, and I was watching television with a couple of friends in their flat, which had used to be my flat in Johannesburg, and there was a home invasion, and three young men with guns, young black men with guns, we were three older white people, held us up, threatened us with death, tortured us, raped my friend. It was horrifying, and there was no. I mean, I lived for those 3 hours as if, you know, with the certitude that I was going to die. You know, as did my two friends, and we came out of it okay. And we, you know, we've been through counselling, and you know, we're all fine now. And it was a very difficult moment for me in terms of how to deal with this book, because Johannesburg, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, has this reputation for being a very violent place. But the whole notion of my book is a notion of kind of rediscovering urbanism in Johannesburg and sort of reclaiming the city. And I didn't want to write another book about Johannesburg that's about crime and violence and battening down the hatches, but yet this thing had happened to me. And because the book is a book about my relationship with Johannesburg, I had to deal with it. I couldn't pretend it didn't happen. But I didn't end the book with it. I was very clear that even though this is a very serious problem in South Africa, and we can look at the roots of this problem, maybe that's another whole discussion as to why there's such a problem of criminal violence in South Africa. By the way, it wasn't in any way racially motivated, the attack. It was economically motivated. There was nothing in our interaction that suggested any kind of hate towards us because we were white. It was people who wanted our stuff because we were rich compared to them, even though we're not so rich. But I made a point of rather than ending the book with that, and at the time I was living in France at the time, rather than kind of scuttling off back to France, I made a point of staying in Johannesburg and kind of reclaiming the street for myself and remembering what it is that is so important to me about Johannesburg and the city, and not succumbing, as so many people do, to the kind of racial profiling that says every black man is a threat to you, because I think that that's A, not true, and B, a terrible way to live. So I tried to kind of, I tried and I think succeeded in overcoming the kind of racist and perfectly understandable response that can happen after a terrible crime like that.
Mark, what was interesting though, after the, you know, that attack, your description of it is incredible, and the minutiae you go into, you observe how the attackers dress, you wonder, you realise from the words they use, they were probably guys who were brought up well, they address your older friend as grandmother, you have a sense of who they were. But afterwards, you know, in that aftermath, you introduce Johannesburg almost as a character again. You say it's, you know, this humanistic city where actually it rallies around when things like this happen. And I think that's also the warmth that comes across. You present this city really as a kind of a healing place, and you describe how, you know, many friends of all colours kind of rally around, and literally it's at one or two points kind of hug people and hold on to them to kind of make you feel that it's okay. How important was it that Johannesburg was that character in this book?
I mean, I think that's what that's Johannesburg. I think you've put your finger on it beautifully. Thank you for that. That Johannesburg is precisely that character in the book. I mean, this book goes on the shelves under the memoir category because it needs to go somewhere, and the publisher said, you will call this a memoir. And I've always been quite uncomfortable with calling it a memoir. I kind of, even though it is a memoir and I do write in the personal register and it is subjective and I tell these stories as you know, my childhood and the attack and everything, it feels much more like a very personal biography of a city to me. And as a personal biography of a city, you know, I'm a biographer, my previous book was a biography of Thabo Mbeki, and one of the things I know when you're writing a biography is that your protagonist has to have a character, and that character has to have a sort of character arc. And I really do think that, I do think of Johannesburg that way, and in this book, and in fact, I plotted Johannesburg that way. I had, you know, up on my pinboard with my post-its, a character arc for Johannesburg and my relationship with Johannesburg. And I much prefer thinking of the book as a biography of a city rather than an autobiography of myself.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
That was Mark Gevisser, whose memoir Lost and Found in Johannesburg is out now.
Up next, we hear about an art exhibition exploring the London that never was.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Here at Monocle 24, words such as modernism and regeneration are common currency when I host The Urbanist each week, a show about cities and urbanism. But head to a new show from the Fine Arts Society here in London, and you'll find such terms equally at home in the world of contemporary art.
A new group show from the Society presents work from artists all looking at the social effects of urban regeneration, casting a critical eye over the failed project of modernism, suggesting a London that never quite was. The exhibition is called Ghosts and offers a sense of living in the remnants. Walter Benjamin would be proud.
Well, we're joined now by its curator, Lee Cavalieri, who's the head of contemporary art at the Fine Arts Society here in London, and also the artist Stuart Semple, whose work features on the show and is going to be joining us on the line. Lee, let's start with you. The idea for the show is about failed modernism, urbanism, an unusual idea in a way for a group show. What brought you to this idea?
The show came very much out of the idea, you know, what we're seeing around us right now in London, which is this kind of endless expansion project. London was, you know, more or less obliterated, parts of London during the Second World War, and there was this notion that it could be renewed socially and physically through architecture. That didn't quite pan out, obviously, as a lot of these kind of social architecture projects that were really kind of revolutionary were kind of abandoned or watered down. So what we end up with is this kind of future in which we're kind of living in the remnants of this kind of this dream of modernism where we have these housing estates that aren't really functioning and are now being torn down. There's also the issue around central London where we're seeing, you know, cultural institutions around Soho, and we're even having galleries in Mayfair being shoved out as the space is being used instead for more kind of short-term commercially viable projects. So the artists are essentially, they're brought together in order to kind of look at that problem and question it and question the kind of long-term effects socially of that kind of regeneration rather than renewal, because the modernists' idea of renewal has very much been replaced or supplanted by this notion of regeneration, which isn't really necessarily interested in culture and social effect.
And we've got Stuart Semple, one of the artists, on the line. Thanks for joining us. Maybe you can tell us, I mean, a lot of your work is sort of about, you might be able to correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel it's about kind of nostalgia for things quite recently past. Was this a nice project to get your teeth into?
It was. I mean, it's something that's very much been on my radar anyway. I mean, when I moved to London over a decade ago, I was in the East End and I saw artist communities be pushed out by the sort of gentrification and that kind of thing. And, you know, a lot of the things that really inspire my work, the culture in general, the popular culture, I'm seeing get kind of homogenized and cleaned up and pushed away. And my work really deals with kind of trying to preserve things like that and bring them into art and have a look at them in a different kind of context. So, yeah, it made a lot of sense.
Lee, when we come back to you here in the studio, what's interesting, some of the artists are looking at the notion of suburbia, how that's changed, and the kinds of people who today live in suburbia. There's all elements of the city looked at here. But the funny thing is, for many people who live in London, I guess they think of it as a success story. It's this huge engine of, you know, making money, of pulling people in. It's still a kind of a magnet for all sorts of people, even for artists. But do you feel when people look at London also they see a bit of a failed city then?
I'm not sure if the success is more to do with the short-term financial gains. Essentially, the problem is that the city, or the question perhaps, is that the city is being carved up and sold off bit by bit in order to basically cover our own rent. and it seems to be at any cost that this is being done. I mean, Stuart will tell you about one particular area that he's concentrating on in Denmark Street in Soho. You know, recently around Tottenham Court Road, we've got an awful lot of these kind of cultural symbols and cultural markers being kind of eradicated, like the, you know, the Paolozzi mosaics being demolished, you know, a couple of weeks ago is a good example. And people are kind of starting to wonder whether the ends justify the means here. You know, we are paying the way right now, but in 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 years' time, are we going to look back and regret the impact that this 10-year project is having?
Well, Stuart, maybe we can bring you in then. And Denmark Street always was Tin Pan Alley, wasn't it? It was the musical hub of a very musical city. Maybe you can tell us what Lee's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, one of my pieces, actually Lee's going to put it in the window of the Fine Arts Society, is the actual door from the 12 Bar, which was closed officially on the 15th of January. But the 12 Bar was an amazing place. We had fantastic musicians frequented, and the whole of Tin Pan Alley, in fact, inspired loads of people. I mean, Hendrix was down there, and you know, Jeff Buckley played at the 12 Bar. And that was inhabited by a group of squatters up until a couple of weeks ago, who were forcibly evicted by the police, who sort of battering rammed the door in and sort of dragged them out in quite a sort of epic display, if you like. And I've become somehow the custodian of this 12-bar door, which seems to be a real symbol, actually, for the sort of demise of what's a really important cultural part of the city, and, you know, and a lot of people's histories as well.
Stuart, do you feel then that, you know, the part of the artist in this is, you know, of course, making work that's, you know, that touches on these points, but do you feel that almost a kind of campaigning role as well? Because what's interesting, you know, the door you refer to, the images you've done, that many of the other people have done here, do point to some real questions that need to be answered about who the city is for, how you create some sense of, you know, equality in a city where there is such a kind of a pull between the haves and the have-nots in a way that we've never seen before. You know, that we see, you know, billionaires from around the world coming here to kind of put their cash into kind of buildings and houses that they have no intention of ever living in. There's this kind of strange pulling away of our city. Do you feel a bit of a kind of a campaigning voice in your work as well?
Of course I do, yeah. I mean, massively. Actually, most of the work that I've made for the show focuses on people, families, people who love each other, people who hold each other, people who live in cities, normal people who are seeing their world change. And yes, you're totally right. On one end, you've got these buy-to-leave properties that are seen as massive sort of overseas investments. And at the same time, we're facing what can only be described as a sort of brutal housing crisis. And you're seeing people like the E15 mums being driven out of their homes and protesting in a very direct way to, you know, they've thank God they've got 40 new council houses. But yeah, of course, I mean, I see my art as political art, and I think it's, you know, it's something that art should be tackling and doing. I mean, that's what art's for, isn't it?
Yeah, Stuart, on this, on the door, are you simply the custodian of it? Will it be displayed in its naked state, or do you have to do anything to it to add any power to it? It sounds like quite a potent symbol on its own.
All I've done is, after the police battering rammed it, the top bit was separated from the door. So one of the squatters managed to get half the door back to Streatham on the 159 bus using a Tesco trolley, and the other half ended up in a youth hostel on Tottenham Court Road. So all I've done is bring the two elements together and move them into art, if you like, so that they can be looked after and kept safe. I mean, the last thing we're trying to do is sort of privatise the door or anything like that. It's to look after the door, bring it into art so it's there, preserved, and people can see it. And, yeah.
I got a very excited text message from Stuart a couple of weeks ago about this, saying something very exciting's happened. He didn't think I'd go for it at all because he thought it was a mad idea. But I think, actually, it's become, the door itself has become this kind of cultural artifact, you know, it's kind of archaeology now. So kind of preserving it in the window of the Fine Arts Society and placing it within that context, it reframes it kind of quite beautifully. And also, you know, we're not just talking about Soho here, you know, Mayfair is facing the same pressures. You know, the Fine Arts Society has been there for 140 years next year. We've just had our rents doubled, as most people around that area have. So these pressures aren't limited to the, you know, the bars and the, you know, the clubs of Soho. There are pressures on every area of culture in London, and I think putting this door within that context and putting this show indeed in that context raises that kind of awareness and the fact that we are all dealing with these issues. I mean, all of the artists here are dealing with the urban environment and urban growth and regeneration in different ways. I mean, you have Laura Oldfield Ford, who has been long been a critic of the ways in which architecture and urbanism can be misused or, you know, unused. You've got Simon Terrell, who originally from Australia, but seeing the same issues there. And he's now working in East London and looking at building projects over there. You've got Macarena Yanez, who's a Chilean street artist. I mean, she uses remnants from old buildings, and she's very much engaged with that, the process of kind of, you know, demolition and renewal. And Juliet Losk, who finds kind of beauty in overgrowth of the city. And then you've got Thomas J. Price, who basically likes to highlight the normal guy in the street and just, you know, populate these areas. So they're all kind of looking at it from different directions.
And I wonder how didactic you wanted to be with your curation of this and your notes around them, because the way you're talking at the moment, Lee, is, you've got a very positive message about the negative messages that are happening in the city, right? What about your curatorial notes? What do we see written on the wall? Are people going to be in any doubt as to perhaps the viewpoint of the artists? Or are you going to let people make their own mind up once they get through the doors of the Fine Arts Society?
I think that the work discusses rather than answers these questions. And I think the different angles and directions that the artists are coming from really kind of, they open up the debate, and also the context, you know, showing it on Bond Street as we are, also helps that and helps to kind of to push these ideas forwards a bit. Yeah, it's a discussion piece as a show, and it's also an international discussion piece. It's not just about London. It is kind of, it broadens the question out to look at all kind of aspects of urban growth and regeneration and the ways that we interact with our urban surroundings.
Stuart, I wanted to ask you a question. That obviously, there's an element of the show which is about the failure of modernism and how, you know, those housing estates and the buildings that went up after the war, you know, many of them didn't stand the test of the time. But interesting, when I look at your, one of the big images that you've done for the show, as Rob hinted before, there's often a sense of nostalgia about your work. There's a, it's a kind of a 50s, 60s kind of almost a pop image of the city in the background. And I wonder if you felt that actually, that in many ways, you know, at least the good thing about that period was, you know, the people had the ambition to create something that was a little bit utopian, and they were certainly thinking about all sorts of people being embraced by the architecture. So while it may have failed in the end, that actually what we've lost is not just buildings, but that sense of, you know, developers, of councils, of cities trying to do something that was, you know, that was aiming at kind of making a better world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a sort of optimism in it, and there was a sort of social calling to make these places come together. And you look at any of those fabulous housing projects, they all had a creche for the kids, somewhere people could get, you know, they were really well thought out, these ideas of futuristic kind of walkways in the sky and everything. And it's a shame it kind of didn't happen. I mean, you look at Tottenham Court Road station now and you talk about architecture, I mean, that's probably the naffest design I've seen ever. I mean, it's like some GCSE kid's done it. I mean, if you're going to build something with a purpose that makes things better. Don't go backwards.
Well, that's one of the things, I suppose, as well, is that there's an idea that if it's made of steel and glass, it must be good. I mean, this is the thing that people kind of are afraid of, that people think that everything that's got any concrete in it must be brutalist. I mean, that's something, isn't it?
It's another misinterpretation of that idea, yeah, of modernist clean lines.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us today. That was the artist Stuart Semple and also Lee Cavalieri, who's the head of contemporary art at the Fine Arts Society here in London. And Ghosts, well, it's on from March the 4th until the 10th of April.
And that's it. We've both been very good boys, haven't we? I'm obsessed with, we've got to do this dog show before someone else does it.
Yes, I think we should. I think that's
meanwhile,
a winner.
Between the top of the show when we spoke to Tom Edwards and interviewing all our guests, and well, the little adverty bits that are part of the show, we've devised a brand new programme which should be part of the show.
We'll keep it a secret. Yeah. But we are in the next issue of the magazine. There's a return of a feature we did a year ago, which was very successful, called Ambassador Dogs. And it's the dogs of literally ambassadors around the world. And we have Ambassador Dogs 2 in the next issue. So watch out for that. That's like,
people love that feature.
Yeah.
It's posh people's felines.
Yeah.
Aristocats.
Yeah. You know? You know that? I wanted to do ones that worked in Brussels as well, as technocats.
Eurocats.
Yes, yes.
Nice. Okay. I can't think of another one. Okay. We could be here for some time. You've got to get
cats
off to your Sunday, yes, and so have we. Let's thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Alice Bloch, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.